I'm sorry, but I'm going to read you some more of this.
That's fine.
I couldn't have come to a better place for a happy, healthy summer. The Wheeler household was a matriarchy presided over by George's grandmother, Mary Shaw, the widow of the man who started the farm. Let me stop parenthetically here to tell you that when I met my wife, Marjorie Benedict, I discovered that her grandmother's maiden name was also Mary Shaw. It seemed like a strange coincidence. The Wheeler, she was a Scotch lady close to 80 years old with the strength and wit rarely found in one so old. Her son-in-law, Frank M. Wheeler, did most of the work around the farm. He had been a bricklayer in Tacoma who came out to the desert country when his health failed. He was a bluff, hearty, sensitive, well-educated man, but a rabid socialist who preferred the news in Oscar Ammerlinger's American Guardian to the Seattle Post Intelligencer, the local newspaper. Mrs. Wheeler, Jeannie, was a quiet, efficient, cheerful woman who helped her mother keep house and supervise work in the fruit packing shed. Three of the Wheeler's six children were on the farm that summer, Helen 15, Donald 17, and Rose 24. Rose and her husband, Wib Morford, and the three sweet Wheeler grandchildren lived in a bungalow on a farm near the river. The rest of the family lived in Mrs. Shaw's three-story house at the other end of the farm. There's a description here of the farm that I'll skip. The Wheeler land sloped gently down to the beautifully clear, blue, cold Columbia River, which flowed majestically by. Are you familiar with that part of the world? Have you
been out there? I've never been up there.
I'll read this. The contrast with the lush, green, irrigated farmland was unforgettable. All day long, the sun beat down from the clear, piercing blue sky. At night, myriads of stars shone, undimmed by city lights. Sunrises and sunsets were perpetual surprises. On exceptionally clear days, we could see snow-covered Mount Rainier, 100 miles west, pink in the early morning sun. Oh, what a scene. The days were hot.
And we don't play golf.
Okay, have a good day, dear. I'm reminiscing. But there was a dry breeze, and the nights were cool and dewless. I was comfortable sleeping out of doors on my poncho on the farm's alfalfa pile. I was there for 3 months, and I wasn't rained on one night.
My gosh.
We worked 6 days a week, and on Sunday we rested, read, or swam. I learned how to harness and drive a team of horses, crank and drive a Model T Ford, run a sprayer, and pick and pack fruit without bruising it. On a typical work day, I was awakened at 5:30 by a rooster crowing in the trees over my haystack. After a swim in the nearby river, I had a hearty breakfast at 6:30 and started work at 7. Dinner was served at noon, and we rested or read during the midday heat until 2 in the afternoon. We worked until 6 sharp when we had supper and worked until dusk. After that, I had another short swim and went to the haystack at 9:30. Work was varied. This is also relevant. I simply can't help but not read it to you. On one day, I dug a hole for a power pole. On another, I weeded the strawberry patch. I also pitched hay. During July and August, while fruit was maturing, most of Donald's and my time was spent spraying fruit. During harvest time, I picked fruit from tall ladders, putting delicate peaches into baskets and stronger apples into bags on my shoulders. I helped Mrs. Wheeler run fruit through the washer, sorted it by size, and packed it lovingly in a geometric array in boxes. On Sundays and in the evenings, the Wheeler children, their neighbor friends, and I would picnic, sing around a bonfire, or go swimming in the river. I enjoyed the company of Louise Shin, a neighbor's daughter, and jokingly called her the light of my life. On Sunday, Donald and I rode across the river, climbed the steep bluffs, and hunted for rattlesnakes in the desert. Shortly before the end of the summer, to climax my adventures, I swam across the Columbia, that's a good mile, in a strong current, while Wib, who was one of the local son-in-laws, rode beside me for a rescue that wasn't needed. Because of the swift current, I touched the west bank 3 miles below where I left the east. The Wheelers had a good assortment of books and a Victrola with some fine old recordings. My most vivid recollection is of listening to Gladys Swartout sing K for Ro Sends Our Eurydice from Glick's Orfeo, and then going outside to see moonlight on the far off hills with a haunting melody running through my mm-hmm. mind. Are you familiar with that?
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful area.
Mm-hmm.
By the end of August, most of the fruit had been harvested and it was time for me to leave. The 2 months of carefree, healthy work had made me strong in body and sound in mind. My adventures in traveling across the continent and becoming a productive farmhand gave me a self-confidence and, in a sense, made a man of me. My black moods were gone forever. Without much conscious effort to reach a decision, I knew that I was destined to be a chemist, and that even though the world might have more need of a social scientist, that was not my bent. In addition to the personal well-being the Wheelers gave me, they showed me a kind of American life now fast disappearing, the family farm. Even though the Wheelers scarcely stayed solvent financially, they led a healthy, productive, self-reliant life in beautiful surroundings. I didn't exaggerate when I wrote my parents that White Bluffs was, quote, a little bit of Eden, and that my summer there, quote, will always be a bright spot in my life. And indeed it was.
Mm. Yes.
Now there's a
that's excellent.
Well, there's a sequel to this that's very poignant. George Wheeler. You know, how did this? Yes, he was an economist, and when the war started, oh gosh, I can't remember the name of the agency in Washington that was set up to sort of. Streamlined American industry for the most efficient production in the conduct of the war. And he went to work for that agency. OSRD, was it the OSRD? No, I don't know. Well, it was some government agency at any rate. And that led him into government service of various sorts. And he was subsequently assigned to be the economic attaché after the war at the U.S. Embassy in Prague, the capital of Czechoslovakia. And while there, I don't know the fact that he had temporarily joined the Communist Party earlier in life or something. At any rate, it led to his either actually being fired from his job or his being insecure and knowing that he would lose his job. So he defected to the Soviet Union and wrote some kind of a letter that was widely publicized criticizing the U.S. government for its conduct of the war and showing that he was far more sympathetic to the Russian way of life than he was to the U.S. way of life. And I was horribly afraid that my application for clearance by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission would be denied when it was found that I had been a friend of George Wheeler and that I had worked for his parents' fruit farm in Washington, where his father was a rabid socialist. And I, of course, had told the interviewers for my clearance, all the places that I had worked, but I hadn't mentioned the fact that Mr. Wheeler was a socialist, or that his son had defected to the Soviet Union. And I had just accepted this job at MIT with the expectation that I would use my previous employment by the Atomic Energy Commission and my security clearance to obtain a personal knowledge of classified technology, which I would then mentally declassify to the extent of writing some notes, which I would then submit for clearance before teaching my class. But at any rate, MIT hired me because I had this contact with the Atomic Energy Commission, this prior employment there, and access to classified information, even though I wasn't allowed to use it in teaching. So the Wheeler defection occurred just after I had reported for work at MIT, and I was living in mortal terror that the very diligent investigators would discover the Wheelers, for whom I had worked in the state of Washington, were the parents of the George Wheeler, who was then in the newspapers as a government official who had defected to the Soviet Union. And my wife knew what was bothering me, and she did something that I would never have occurred to myself, and which was very kind of her. She served me a good stiff drink. But the government never found out that my farm employment in the state of Washington had led me to had been as a result of a friendship from a guy who had given up the U.S. diplomatic service in favor of a lifelong exile to the Soviet Union. The coincidences that occur in a person's life. Yes. You know, when you live as long as I have, all sorts of these strange things happen.
Did you ever have any contact with him after he defected at all? In later years?
I don't remember. I do remember that I traveled, whatever took me to Czechoslovakia. Gosh, I can't remember that. But at any rate, I did make a business trip to Czechoslovakia once. I was in Prague, and I looked in the telephone directory for George Wheeler, but I can't remember whether I found his name or not. But at any rate, I never had any further direct contact with him. I lost track of him altogether. He was a brilliant man. It's just a shame that he couldn't use his talents in this country.
How did you decide on MIT in 1931?
Well, I was studying, I wasn't studying, I was working in Washington State, as I told you, and the opportunity to get my wits back together again, and the realization that I should study chemistry rather than economics, led me to realize that I needed to go to a school where I could get a better education in chemistry, physical chemistry, than I had at Cornell. And my brother, Bill Benedict, had gone directly from Cornell to MIT and was studying physical chemistry there. So that it seemed a natural thing to do, to go there also. And that was, of course, one of the best involuntary decisions I ever made, because it was my MIT education in chemical thermodynamics that enabled me to do the professional work that gave me a good professional reputation.
Can you tell me something about that MIT department? You were in chemistry, not chemical engineering.
That's right.
Okay.
Well, the chemistry department, the first year I was there, was under the directorship of Frederick G. Keyes. Well, I guess I'll have to... First year I was there, I registered for four courses, three of which were absolutely splendid. The fourth, the kinetic theory of gases, was taught by Frederick G. Keyes, the head of the department, whose administrative duties didn't give him enough time to present class material properly. I took advanced calculus, taught by Jesse Douglas, a shy, brilliant mathematician who made infinite series and multiple integrals crystal clear. I wrote of his class, "I'm just beginning to discover what mathematics really is, and I'm learning with regard to mathematics what I suspected of most of everything I had been taught at Cornell, that I had been taught only what someone thought I would need in the usual pursuit of chemistry instead of teaching anything for its own sake," which was perfectly true. John Slater, head of the physics department, gave lectures and introduction to theoretical physics that were perfectly organized and introduced me to the beauties of Lagrange's equations in mechanics and Maxwell's equations in electricity and magnetism. That first year at MIT really was a turning point in my own professional education. Best of all were Louis Gillespie's inspiring lectures on thermodynamics and chemistry. Have you ever heard of Gillespie? He was a...
No, I'm afraid I haven't. I saw that name, but I have not.
He was an unusually brilliant and versatile man. The text was J. Willard Gibbs' Equilibrium of Heterogeneous Substances. Do you know that?
Yes. Yes.
And Gillespie led us through it, and Gillespie led us through that classic paper page by page. It was wonderful. It was my first experience with reading a text where every word counted and where you knew if you studied long enough that you would fully grasp the author's meaning. That class, more than anything else, provided the tools I needed for the successful research I did in my first important industrial assignment 6 years later, which was the development of the Benedict-Webb-Rubin equation of state. In the spring term, I took the second part of Slater's theoretical physics lectures and Lehmann Rice's class in modern algebra. The latter's treatment of line integrals, determinants, and matrices were also useful in my subsequent research. I started research in my master's thesis, which was a small part of an extensive multi-year many-student research program directed by Professor James A. Beatty on precise methods for measuring centigrade temperatures on the international temperature scale and relating these measurements to the absolute temperatures required for strict application of the second law of thermodynamics. My research was on an experimental realization of the fixed points of the centigrade scale, which in 1930 were the ice point, the equilibrium temperature between ice and water, the pressure of one atmosphere, and the steam point, the equilibrium temperature between water and its vapor pressure at normal atmosphere. My research was considered building equipment and establishing the fact that they measured these two temperatures within the required precision. Well, there's lots more of this, but I don't think you want all this detail, do you?
Well, I'm interested in the people you were associated with at MIT and the kind of work that you did.
Well, I'll read you some more. By using the resistance of a platinum resistance thermometer for reference, I found that it was difficult to reproduce the temperature of the ice point as customarily measured by better than a thousandth of a degree because of the above factors. Variation in the barometric pressure and the difficulty of saturating the water with air before conducting the measurements. By using a specially designed, shielded, and clean vessel containing only pure water, pure ice, pure water, and water vapor free of all other gases, I found it possible to reproduce the triple point of water within 3/10,000ths of a degree centigrade. The temperature of the triple point relative to the ice point, determined by measuring the change in resistance of a platinum resistance thermometer, I found to be 0.010 plus or minus 0.00005 degrees centigrade. I compared this with the temperature difference between the triple point of pure water and the equilibrium temperature of ice in contact with air at atmospheric pressure, which I calculated by Gibbsian thermodynamics and found to be 0.00990 plus or minus 0.00005 degrees centigrade.
What sort of a person was Beattie?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that I've actually written anything about him, but I should have. He was a rather shy man. It was hard to get to know him well. He was a brilliant thermodynamicist and a very excellent experimentalist too, which is a splendid combination for a chemist. And rather indifferent lecturer. He was a rather shy person. And like myself, he didn't speak in a very loud voice, and his lectures were kind of hard to assimilate for that reason. Gillespie was a much better lecturer than Beattie was. But doing experimental research under him was a splendid education, because he was a master of experimental technology, and he taught me how to do careful research and be accurate in reporting the results. So it was really a splendid education. It was also helpful to me in getting me the National Research Fellowship that I took at Harvard after I graduated from MIT, where I had the unexpected good fortune of doing it under Percy Bridgman, who doubtless are familiar with. Both a master of experimental research and a really splendid philosopher of science, because he wrote a book whose name I've now forgotten. He wrote two books. One of them was on, oh dear, oh heck.
Well, I can check the
philosophy of physics, I think one of them was called, and the other was on experimental physics. At any rate, he was a splendid person to work under, because Beattie had been a very careful experimentalist using the most expensive kind of equipment you could imagine, platinum resistance thermometers and gas thermometers and things of that kind. Bridgman, on the other hand, was what you might call a quick and dirty experimentalist. He was most ingenious at developing his high-pressure equipment, carried experiments to much higher pressures than anybody before him had, in the simplest kind of equipment you could imagine, built on almost a shoestring. And it was really a splendid combination to work for Beattie, a precise experimentalist with elaborate equipment, and Bridgman, a highly original experimentalist with primitive but quite appropriate equipment. Mm-hmm.
So your PhD thesis was with Beattie
on the gas thermometer, the comparison of the platinum resistance thermometer with the gas thermometer.
I think that shows up in a number of these early publications.
That's correct, yeah. Well, there's a long account in here of my search with Beatty that I won't bore you with. But I do think you'd find it helpful to have copies of
some of this. Oh, yes. Yes, excellent. Yes, absolutely. We would like copies. At this point, were you pretty well set in your own mind now as to where you were going with your...
Oh, yes, I was going to be a chemist. And while I was at MIT, I had the good fortune to meet the girl who's been my wife now for, what year is this now,
1991. So you were married in...
35.
Yes.
Well, Marjorie... keep remembering what her maiden name was. Marjorie Oliver Allen was a graduate student in physical chemistry who came to MIT a year after I had come there, and while I was doing research on the gas thermometer in room 6231 on the second floor of the Eastman Research Laboratory at MIT, Marjorie Allen was the chemistry department at that point assigned the students to do research with different professors. The students had no choice in it at all. She was assigned to do research with George Scatcher on the freezing point of aqueous solutions, and her laboratory was in room 6232 across the hall from mine at MIT. And her research required her to shave, is it 50 or 75 or 100 pounds, I can't remember, but at any rate, a large number of pounds of ice every day and hand crank ice shaver. And I didn't think that was a job for a girl to do, so I shaved the ice for her. That led to our becoming good friends. And subsequently, after I got my PhD degree and before she got her PhD degree, we married. And we lived happily ever after. Did you meet her this morning?
Yes. Yes.
Very happy marriage.
That's wonderful.
And the fact, of course, that she knew chemistry made her a much more understanding companion when during the war I had to work 57 hours a week, and the only time I saw her was when I came home after working at night until 9:30 or 10 o'clock and having to go directly to bed. So it's been very helpful.
Did she get her PhD subsequently?
Oh, yes. She got her PhD with George Scatcherd and worked for a year and 3 months under Edwin Cohn at the Physical Chemistry Laboratory of the Harvard Medical School, where she worked on the freezing points of aqueous solutions and glycine, which I think is aminoacetic acid, and aqueous solutions.